Experiment.
I love you, man. That could just be the sermon. Let's be done.
Hey, everyone. We're going to talk about a couple passages about forgiveness. We'll start with the one probably everybody's very familiar with, Matthew 6, the Lord's Prayer. It starts, "Pray then in this way. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Do not bring us to the time of trial, but rescue us from evil. For if you forgive others their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you." Okay. Sure, we have another one about forgiveness that ties in nicely. It's Matthew 18. It's one of my favorite ones. 22 through...
Favorite?
It is. Matthew 22 through 35. It's a conversation between Peter and Jesus. It's not up on the thing, so I'm just going to talk about it from my head. All the disciples, they're all sleeping in the desert. Peter wakes up, sees everyone else asleep, except for Jesus, who's standing up, staring at the stars. Of course, he's Jesus, so he's not sleeping. So Peter says, "I can have some one-on-one time with Lord. I'm going to get up, pick his brain." So he walks up to him, and he says, "Jesus, let me ask a question. How many times should we forgive our brothers for trespassing against us? Seven times?" Jesus shakes his head. "No, not seven times. 70 times seven." Big number. Do the math, it's 490 times. So then Jesus takes a step back and delivers a parable to illustrate his point, as he is apt to do, and says, "Let me explain. God is like a Lord here on earth who has his servants. He is looking at all of his accounts and realizes that one of his servants owes him 10,000 talents. 10,000 talents. I'm not a conversion expert, but I'm assuming that's a lot of money. He says, "Bring this man to me." So one of his servants is brought to him, and he says, "You owe me 10,000 talents. You know what I'm going to do? Can you pay me?" The guy goes, "No, I can't pay you. I am going to sell you into slavery. I am also going to sell your wife and your children into slavery and all of your possessions, so that I can get my money." This man drops down to his knees and says, "No, please, Lord, don't sell me into slavery." Aside, he does not mention anything about his wife or children being sold. So the Lord looks at him and says, "All right, I have some compassion for you. I'm going to loosen my grip. I'm going to forgive you of this debt." This man gets up. Thank you, my Lord. I appreciate it. That's amazing. He gets up, he walks outside, he sees one of his fellow servants, and he runs over to him and says, "Hey, you owe me 100 pence. I'm assuming that, again, the conversion between pence and talents is 100 pence is probably a much, much smaller debt. He grabs him by the throat and says, "You owe me 100 pence, pay me now." This servant drops to his knees and says, "I cannot pay you, but please, just give me time. I'll get you your money. Just give me some time." He goes, "No, absolutely not. I am going to throw you into prison until you pay me my 100 pence. A lot of their friends have witnessed this. They are very displeased. They run back to their Lord and they tell him what just happened. The Lord says, bring that man to me. He's brought back in. He's like, "Hey, what's going on?" His Lord looks at him and he says, "I know what you did. I showed compassion to you. I forgave you of your huge debt. I heard what you did to your friend. So I've decided to revoke my compassion, and you will now also be thrown into jail." and you will be tormented until your debt is repaid. And with that, Jesus ends his parable. He takes a step back, and now we're back in the desert with Peter and Jesus, and Peter looks at him like, okay. And then Jesus says, now that is a metaphor for how you will be judged by God when you get to heaven. If you want God to forgive your sins, then you better forgive all the trespasses of the people here on earth against you. And that's how it went. And if we remember, that those two tie very well in together.
Wow.
I can't wait for the Ty London unabridged version.
Impromptu story time with Ty.
Good. It's good.
That was wonderful.
That was a great setup, because we're going to dig at this a little bit.
Hey, Chris, before we get started, I just want you to know something. I forgive you. I don't know what you've done.
You do know what I've done.
You haven't asked for forgiveness. I'm just writing you a blank check. If you ever need it, I forgive you.
I need it more than you can imagine.
Well, don't use it early. You might want to save it.
Oh, I'm just going to live it. Because let's talk about this forgiveness thing. And what I would like to do is talk about what it is and what it isn't.
Okay.
And in my experience, and even as a part of my history, one of those places where I deeply need forgiveness is the way that this has been talked about in the churches I participated in, mm-hmm. in inappropriate ways.
One of the reasons it's good for our sermons to be in dialogue is because we can bring different things to the table. For instance, I appreciate that you're telling me, you know, what it's like to need forgiveness.
Because you'd never experienced that. It's a new...
It's not really in my wheelhouse, as Brad says. I haven't... I haven't curated
it.
No. We all need forgiveness, right? But it's weird because forgiveness gets used so many different ways mm-hmm. that it can be really confusing. For instance, sometimes when people are like, you just need to forgive that person, but what they mean is don't be mad at them anymore.
Yeah.
We don't mean that.
And most of the time when they say that, it's not necessarily about the person who we're asking to do the forgiveness work. It's about trying to hold on to either what the church is, the community is. I've seen this be deeply wounding.
Yeah?
Oh, my gosh. I worked with orphans for a very long time.
Okay.
And these children, many of them who were moving into young adulthood, had been wronged by the people who were assigned by God to be the most stable and protective in their life.
Okay.
And these people had failed them miserably.
Okay.
There are things in their stories that were so horrific and so hard to understand. And the church would double down on that horror and say, you got to forgive that person. And if you don't forgive them, God is not going to forgive you. They would take this message from Jesus and go to a child wounded by a parent and say, God's going to treat you the same way. And the pain that would erupt in someone who's been wounded at their core by something that has happened is to miss the point of what forgiveness is entirely. Mm. So I want to talk about that for a few minutes as we get into this, what forgiveness is not.
Okay.
Forgiveness is not is where I want to start. All right. Then we can talk about what it is.
So I would like to say that one of the reasons I think we run into forgiveness and the problems with this is that we'd have this twofold problem we get stuck in. One is, after the Enlightenment, we're, you know, in this European Western mentality, we think in financial terms. We use banking as like a model for our relationship with God and our relationship with each other. And so the Hebrew mind did not have, even though they would maybe use, like Ty talked about, the financial metaphors, but they didn't have that banking transaction thing that we are so comfortable with, where you have a debt, right? And the longer you hold on to that debt without it being repaid, the more you accrue, right? It becomes worse. And so we have this magical thinking because we've been taught that God created, it's called ex nihilo, out of nothing. And so where does forgiveness start? It just magically appears with God. God has all of it and just dumps it on us, right?
Yeah.
And then we read a transactional thing that says, if you don't forgive, God won't forgive you. And since that's where the cash flow starts, is with God, you don't want God withholding forgiveness, because it's not like you can generate forgiveness on your own, right?
Yeah.
So it becomes very transactional.
Yes.
So you pay off yours because you know God's going to pay you, And it becomes this really like a pyramid scheme of forgiveness.
And I think that pyramid scheme, just the metaphor we frame this in, mm-hmm. becomes very wounding to people who are dealing with hurt on
sure.
any level,
sure.
but particularly those who've been traumatized.
Yeah.
So forgiveness is not. So forgiveness is not condoning what that other person did. It is not. In fact, it's almost the opposite. Forgiveness, in its true sense, outside of this economic exchange model, mm-hmm. forgiveness is actually naming it for what it really was, the depth of the injury, mm. and talking about it as a real thing, and then moving through mm. that.
In order
it's
for
not
there
setting
to...
it aside. It's not forgiving yeah. in the sense of an economic thing where it evaporates.
Right.
It's moving through it.
In order to forgive somebody, you have to acknowledge that there has been a wound, that something was injured, something was harmed. Otherwise, what would you be forgiving? There'd be no need for forgiveness.
Converse to that, so something that forgiveness is, it is the act of digging something up to name it for what it really is. It's there's a delicate balance here we need to talk our way through, but sometimes in the church, you just need to forgive them.
Yeah.
And just walk, don't worry about it anymore. And it really erodes at our personhood because we can't take seriously the wound we carry.
Yeah.
We have to somehow just say, oh, it's no big deal. But it was a big deal. So how do we move through it and let it be the big deal that it is without it consuming us?
You and I are big fans of relational understandings of both God and Scripture. We think that it holds more potential for us as a community and a more vibrant picture of what it looks
Absolutely.
Like to live in relationship with God in community,
in conversation.
Right?
Yeah.
So this relational understanding, if we move from a transactional to a relational, then this isn't a threat where Jesus says, if you don't forgive somebody, God's not going to forgive you, not in a transactional sense, but in a relational sense, that there's an economy of grace, that grace is a That's a gift.
A gift economy.
It's a gift economy.
It's moving away from a transactional one.
And so giving forgiveness to somebody, whether they deserve it, whether they requested it, whatever it is, if we move out of a banking model into a relational model, I am actually creating more good with which God can work.
So as you said that, forgiveness is not waiting for someone else to confess what they did.
Okay. Because you could be waiting a while.
You could wait forever. One of the writers I was reading this week says, not forgiving is allowing someone else to rent free space in your head. It's to linger on something they may not even know is there, or they don't care. And really, what I want to talk about, forgiveness and reconciliation. Reconciliation is communal. Forgiveness is more individual. It's almost not about the act or the person that did it. It's what's still hooked into us. That this act of reconciliation that comes later, maybe. But what we're talking about today, forgiveness is about me. It's about you. It's about an individual coming to grips with something. And this is a spiritual yeah. practice, not just an event.
So kind of the fun that I have is if you break the word down, you have for and given, right? So we know for from foreplay. Usually that's before, usually, right? That's generally
You're
where we
sets.
Get that.
Keep going. All right,
and
I'm listening.
And then you have
You got
given.
Everybody's attention. Everybody's sat up. He said foreplay.
And then you have given. And then you have given, right? So it's given before. That's kind of a little wordplay you can do. Forgiven is given before because you can't wait on the other person.
It may never come. And really, that's not what forgiveness is.
Yeah.
So forgiving is not forgetting what happened either. Mm. It's now the best relationships, hopefully marriages, friendships we've had for a long time, the best relationships,
siblings,
stuff happens, you work through it, you reconcile, you talk about the trauma of it, you try to say, I'm never going to have that again. And you can say, it's as if it never happened. You can
mm-hmm.
walk through that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really like that stance as much.
Yeah.
I rather walk through the forgiveness and say, since it has happened, we have a new reality, and that reality is actually better than it was before because
mm-hmm.
we've had some space. I've mm-hmm. had rifts with friends in here that I think I'm better because we went through that than without it. So, but it sometimes people say forgive and forget.
Yeah.
But forgiving is not forgetting what happened.
Yeah.
You may need to set boundaries with that individual in the future. You've forgiven them. You've unleashed yourself to them.
Hmm.
But you're not living in that space forever in forgiving.
So just point of confession, when Chris and I were getting this ready for this week, I had to have a very frank conversation with him, and so I just want to bring you in on it. I'm not very good at forgiveness. I just need to tell you that pastorally. I am not very good at this. In fact, I knew I was going to miss last week because I was back east, and then I was sick the week before, and then I get back for forgiveness. I'm like, God, I couldn't have missed forgiveness and, like, becoming on one of the areas I'm stronger at. Forgiveness for me is such a tricky thing, and I think it's because, you know, growing up a pastor's kid, and I'm the oldest son, there was this expectation, like you're talking about, like, I had to lead in forgiveness. I had to model that, right? But the problem is I'm a really sensitive cat. I don't know if you know that. I take things really personally. So when
he's a hugger.
So when things go down, dude, I live in that hurt for a really long time. Like, I'm not just good at not, like, forgiveness isn't great. Even once I forgive somebody, I almost can't forget. And so I'm very aware of people in my life who live, who have forgiven me, and live as if we're better. Right? They forgave me, and we're better for it. And sometimes I feel bad that, like, you know, I have this job, but I'm not really good at this part of it.
Well, I'm glad you're able to confess that here and to say that I'm really, really good at it. Thank you, because as the model of Jesus in the room, I would like to thank you for the chance to say, oh, I'm so good at it. I come from the Hatfields and McCoys, man. We're like, we don't forgive. We kill each other. Well, I have family members we cut off for centuries. Yeah. Like, oh, you did not take out the trash, you shall die. Like, I don't think anybody's good at it, to be honest.
Let's talk what forgiveness is then. And not, so we brought up a biblical example, and we have Ty tell these stories, and we're taking on the pyramid scheme of a transactional-based forgiveness system.
Right.
But Paul writes to us that while you are yet a sinner, Christ died for you. That over and over we're talked about grace coming before. We talk about forgiveness.
Yeah.
Wesley talked about prevenient grace, that God has come on our behalf and forgiven us and reconciled us before we do a thing. So whatever Jesus meant in that parable, he did not mean that your relationship with God, your salvation, your personhood has been in any way revoked by your struggle with this being in the flow of forgiveness. Forgiveness is not a one-time transaction. It is not this moment where this person is okay and this once they weren't and now they are. There are no magic words. And if you've had that taught in church or if you've read this scripture yourself and landed at that, and you're walking around with this deep hurt, and you're somehow pissed at God because I can't forgive what's happened. I can't walk away, and I can't forget. It's always there like that refrigerator hum. And if I expect that God is going to act to me like that, I'm out. That is not what forgiveness is.
If my life and my relationships are caught on a letter, on a ledger, sorry, if right?
Yeah. If you write them down, table them up.
I'm going to come up on the short end of this thing pretty bad. People are better to me than I am to them. I know that. People are really good to me. And if I can move towards a relational understanding where we have an economy of grace, right, a gift economy, so that people are extending to me goodness that I live in, and then I continue to participate in that, the goodness grows. And God has more to work with, right, in our circles. So it's not a one-time thing, and it's not a one-directional thing.
So forgiveness is a process. It is to participate in a new economy, and there's a flow to it that God has inaugurated and brought us into that flow. Forgiveness, it starts with awareness. So if you have put a name on that board, you started. Forgiveness is occurring by writing it down and putting it somewhere, by bringing it into your heart and your head. It doesn't mean that it's over. It doesn't mean that it's healed. It doesn't mean that reconciliation. It doesn't erase consequences. It doesn't erase costs. But it is to enter a flow. And God has arranged that flow for all of us to participate in. If you wake up tomorrow and that name comes up, and you're a little less angry, a little less furious. That's a victory. That is the gift coming. That is the process taking the next step. Like, I really don't want to talk about forgiveness in the terms of an event that has happened or an event that needs to happen again to get through it, or necessarily about the other person. I want to talk about it. Forgiveness is something that is rooted in us. Okay. It's to refuse to allow someone else to rob us of our joy, to perpetuate the action. We don't forgive someone. We're essentially allowing them to rent the free space in our head. One author writes, I don't love this one, but it's vivid enough that it stayed with me. Not forgiving someone is like drinking rat poison and expecting the rat to die. It's for me to stay in the action, and they are unaware.
Yeah.
It's setting someone free and finding out that it was me. I'm the one still stuck. I'm the one caught. And forgiveness is to enter into a new flow, a new relational economy, a gift economy, not a transactional economic one.
Mm-hmm. When you have a mortgage or a loan from a bank and you pay it all back plus interest, the bank will give you a note that says the debt is forgiven. They actually use that word.
Wrong word. No. It's not forgiven. I paid for that. It's not a gift.
No.
That's the wrong language. And that's the language we inherit.
Right.
I want grace. I want to stand there before the test is given, pray to God, and the answers come. Like, I want grace. Okay. And there's this mixed up thing that happens in the church where we think God came to give us forgiveness. Mm-hmm. That's not in Scripture. God didn't come to forgive us. God came to give us life. Life into the full, to give us joy. Those are the things that God brings. But we mistake that, we need this forgiveness, first of all. No, forgiveness is what allows us to participate in the life, in the joy, in the fullness that God has for us. It is not the purpose of God. It is the economy God sets up so life can come to us. The metaphor I like. Now, if this is hitting some notes for you and you want some work on this, Rob Bell has a podcast called The Robcast, and he's done 5 sessions on forgiveness that are pretty helpful. Most of this stuff is coming from that. I've been in his stuff long enough. I've heard that sermon 15 times. Mm-hmm. So, but it's good. He reintroduced it, and you can put it in your headphones and listen to it in the car. It's sure. Great. But one of the analogies he says is that forgiveness is not an event. It's this process, and it's kind of like a snorkel, that when you go in the ocean, You usually think snorkel, I'm underwater, and I'm breathing, and I'm getting air through the snorkel. But the snorkel is not to give us breath. It's the exchange of life. It's also where breath leaves. We're breathing in and out through this thing. And it's basically not forgiving is to shove some mud in the snorkel. We can't take anything in or get out. When we suffocate, it's not from not enough oxygen. It's from carbon dioxide that's built up in our bloodstream. We can't get it out. So forgiveness is to enter that flow, to enter that process, to a new economy. Mm. So we need to pray. I want Jasmine to come and say a prayer for us, and then we'll have a quick conversation about this.
Morning, everyone. Please join me in prayer. Oh, God, it is hard for me to let go most times. And the squeeze I exert garbles me and gnarls others. So loosen my grip a bit on the good times, on the moments of sunlight and starshine and joy, that the 1,000 graces they scatter as they pass may nurture growth in me rather than turn to brittle memories. Loosen my grip on those grudges and grievances I hold so closely that I may risk exposing myself to the spirit of forgiveness and forgiving that changes things and resurrects dreams and courage. Loosen my grip on my fears that I may be released a little into humility and into an acceptance of my humanity. Loosen my grip on myself that I may experience the freedom of a fool who knows that to believe is to see kingdoms, find power, sense glory. To reach out is to know myself held. To laugh at myself is to be in on the joke of your grace. To attend to each moment is to hear the faint melody of eternity. To dare love is to smell the wild flowers of heaven. Loosen my grip on my ways and words, on my fears and fretfulness, that letting go into the depths of silence and my own uncharted longings, I may find myself held by you and linked anew to all life in this wild and wondrous world you love so much, so I may take to heart that you have taken me to heart.
Be still, my soul, the Lord is on your side. Bear patiently the cross of grief or pain. Leap to your God to order and provide in every change. He will.
Sit with me. We're going to have a little chat for a minute. So one of the things, as a conversational community, we believe that conversation and story really make up who we are, not as individuals, but as the community we inhabit and the world we get to interact with. And I got to learn a little bit of your story over the past couple weeks. And
because of my big mouth boyfriend. I kid.
Your mouth to God's ears.
But that story has been fascinating. But first thing I want to ask, what do you do? Because what you do is fascinating. What do you do?
My job?
Yeah, that job.
Well, I run Lance Bass's production company.
Okay. What does that entail?
Well, I make sure that he travels well. Okay. No, we have, I'm his producing partner. We have a couple TV shows we're trying to get off the ground, and production experience.
So you have a postgraduate degree in production and design and film from what, USC or Jesus of Life?
Jesus of Life. I barely graduated high school by the skin of my teeth, and I did not go to college based on the story that I'm about to share. And it was all life experience and want and how I behaved. And the
so to get to the Lance Bass's production, TV shows and the things that you do, the radio, the podcast, all that stuff. But you had a lot of obstacles getting there. And your story of being in this flow of forgiveness is it's so interesting to me. So I want to get into that a little bit. And I want you to pull that story to the surface for us all to hear what our collective story might be. So who did you have to forgive and where did it start?
Well, so the big story in my life is about my mother. I don't know if any of you guys have mom stories, but I certainly have one for the ages. So the long and short of it is my mom is an addict, and I basically grew up in a very unsafe childhood, and she was... she started doing drugs. I think she did heroin probably around 12 or 13 years old for the very first time. And let's see, just to sort of give some illustrations on who she is. She's the woman, well, first of all, I'm the product of a one-night stand. And she is the one who told me my entire childhood that that she had had two abortions before me, but that she wanted to have me because she wanted to have somebody who would always love her. So the word narcissist is very well applied here. I didn't even know what an abortion was, and I remember 10 years old having to go finally figure that out. I just knew it meant that she had had other, or was supposed to have other babies that she didn't. But that also really kind of like gives you an insight into her mind, was that she was just convinced that by having me that she would have somebody who would love her. And, you know, and so drugs were obviously always around and in her life. And
so what's it like having someone that has drugs all around? What
I mean,
did that lead to drug use for you, or did that lead
did not. For some reason I always had something in my mind that she was the example of who not to be, even though it was a very difficult struggle to not become her, because she made it. I mean, she laid out the path. You know, if you're a parent, you lead by example. And so, you know, I remember being about 18, 19 years old, right as around the time as I was coming out and figuring out myself, and really having to figure out, working really hard to not be her. You know, she was the kind of person who could borrow money from you and was never going to pay you back, but somehow you believed she was going to when you were, you know, paying her cable bill or her electric bill or her rent.
So how did that work out with, did you have support from friends? Did you have friends that were around that could deal with that, or what?
I personally didn't. So I grew up, a lot of people are always surprised. I grew up very lonely. I did not have many friends at all as a child. In addition to being highly effeminate as a child, I had also skipped second grade when we moved up to Washington. And so that made me a year underdeveloped from everybody around me. So I was just basically this weird little freak that was literally bullied and fag, sissy, Tinkerbell, pushed into lockers, all those horrible things that we're always hearing about. And so, no, I didn't. And we had moved up to Washington State, so I didn't have any family support up there. There were a few of my mother's friends who remained friends of my mother for the sake of taking care of me, because they knew how unstable she was. And so they actually didn't want to have much of a relationship with her. But and it's funny, because these people are still in my life, and they've, you know, she's long been out of theirs. But they've told me that they always felt bad because they didn't know what to do, because they knew if they reported her that I would then be lost in the foster care system, which you discussed, which is not always any better. But so instead, they were kind of like my guardian angels, and, you know, they were constantly, you know, giving my mom extra money for food, or, you know, to pay electric bills or rent and whatnot.
So you told me the story about the TV.
Yes.
What happened with your TV?
So that's the backstory. You guys have, I'm guessing, a pretty good idea about the kind of woman my mom was. And right before I graduated high school, I was 17 years old, and she had decided to rent out my bedroom, because that was easier than going and just getting a job. So at 17 years old, I was living on the couch, and then she tried to start charging me rent. So I actually ended up moving out about a month before I turned 18, and living on people's couches and blah, blah, blah. So the relationship at that point was already pretty strained. And then about within the next 2 years, she was living up in Reno, and I was living with these two roommates, and I happened to be house-sitting down the street. This was long before cell phones and everything else. And all of a sudden, I get a call from my roommate, and she's like, Bob, we don't know what's going on. Your mom knocked on the door. She came into your, and she's literally going through your bedroom and going through all your stuff, and she just took your TV. So I'm like, there's like flames coming out of my head, and I figure out where she is, and I drive over to this house, and she's at her friend's house, and sure enough, there's my TV in the passenger seat of her 76 Camaro, because she is white trash, in case you guys couldn't put that image in your mind. She's really short shorts, and she would always cut the V out of her T-shirts and hack them off here, and I'm just going to let you know she's about my size, so really pretty. And I say that because this next part of the story is actually kind of important, and I walked into the house, and there was blind white rage. And I will tell you, it's the one time that when you hear the O.J. Simpson story and you hear that moment of that rage that's just so out of control, it was blind white rage. And the truth is, I don't know who, what, or what I was capable of in that moment. And I barreled into that house. But she did something that was so jarring that everything went silent, and that is, she took her car keys off the coffee table and stuck them between her crotch, and she said, "Life's a bitch, ain't it?" And in that moment, everything just went silent. And I just remember standing there and saying to her, "This is it. This is our moment. We are done. I no longer exist to you. You no longer exist to me. You don't know my name. You don't know my number. You don't know how to get a hold of me." And I pivoted, I walked out that door, and I got in my car, and I'm just trembling, and just, I mean, every emotion is now surfacing in my body. And one of my greatest life lessons, I get home, and I call my Aunt Heidi, and I'm like, what do? Do I call the police? You know, I can press charges. And my aunt gave me the most solid advice that I still live by, and she said, "Bob, if this is about the TV, we will buy you a new TV. But your mom, she knows how to thrive and live on the drama. What she doesn't know is for you to walk away. If you call the police, which you are absolutely justified to do, all you're going to be doing is keeping her in your life, taking her to court, having to keep engaging in this relationship." And as hard as that was, she's so right, because the very next day my life changed, and that's a story for another day. But because of that moment, I had so much fury and rage, because at that point I had 19 years of this woman who had just done one horrible thing after another. At 11 years old, she took all my paper route money and would go gambling with it, and then I got fired, and I never understood why, because they came to the door and said, "Your son collected all the money, but we never received it." So then she made it look like I had been out spending the money. She was really a horrible person. And so I had all of this rage, and so some of the things we've talked about today is that rage and that fear and that animosity also fueled me, because around this time I was living up in San Jose, and I had decided I wanted to move to LA, because in all of my unsafe childhood, the one thing that I always escaped in and always, immersed myself in was pop culture, whether it was reading People magazine or watching MTV for hours on time. That was my escape. That's where I was, my safe, happy place. So I had wanted to move to LA, and so through one thing or another, I had a friend down here, and I made the move happen. And so it fueled me, because there was this thing inside of me that was like, I'm going to show her. I'm going to be the most awesome person, and she's going to be so sorry that she treated me so poorly, that she wasn't a better person, and she's just going to regret the day. So that was the fuel, which on one hand was a great thing, because it moved me to LA. But then there was this really weird thing for like the first 2 years that I lived here, where I lived in complete fear, because mind you, this is the internet is still starting up and stuff, and I would, if I were at a party, like a movie premiere or something, and Entertainment Tonight was there, I would duck, which if anyone knows me now, I can't get in front of the camera fast enough. But then I would duck and I would hide, because I was so afraid that she'd be, wherever she was at that point, because I didn't know, that she'd see where I was, and then I'd have to worry about her showing up on my doorstep. So I loved that analogy of the refrigerator, but that buzzing noise, like she was a constant buzz. So on one hand, it's propelling me forward, and on another hand, it was completely holding me back.
That kind of, I'm going to stick it to you, I'm going to prove it to you, yeah. Fuel it. It's like rocket fuel, mm-hmm. in the sense that there is a lot of power. There is an instantaneous thrust to move in that, but it is a fast-burning, not a lot of longevity, hard-to-live-by fuel.
Mm-hmm.
But you started, I guess about 98, you have this Starbucks encounter
mm-hmm.
where you begin to maybe become aware that that fuel's running out, that there's a different way to live, and there's something awakening in you. So what happens in Starbucks?
So I'm with my friend, we're at coffee, and there's this woman who's sitting there with her tarot cards, and, you know, and I'm a cocky, you know, 21, 22-year-old, whatever I am, and I'm like, oh, I want a reading, you know, and it all means nothing to me, and I really don't care. And she actually gave me this really beautiful reading, but the strange thing was at the very end of it, she's like, I want you to go pick up this book. And the book is called The Game of Life and How to Play It by Florence Scovel Shinn. And it was this book written in 1928. And I don't know why. It was so uncharacteristic of me. I went out and I bought it and I read it. And it really sort of changed my life. It started talking about things like how, you know, if your car breaks down, your car didn't break down because it's mad at you. Your car broke down because your car broke down. Like it started, it was sort of things like that, and it really just sort of was like eye opening. But it also, it also talked about forgiveness, and you know, you used sort of a different version of it. But one of my favorite things in the world is holding a grudge is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. And so I was recognizing that I was holding on to all of this stuff about my mom because, of course, she's the biggest story of my life. And it's funny, I even navigated being gay and coming out. Like, that was like I'm gay. Okay, what's next? You know what I mean? Like, that had no effect on me, but my mom was just this constant buzz. And so that book really sort of started it, and then, it started changing my practice. You know, like, if you got a speeding ticket on your way to work, all of a sudden, you know these people, that you get the speeding ticket, now you walk into the office and you're in this rage, and you're like, I'm having the worst day ever. And everything is like, you have to tell every single person, I got pulled over by the cops today, I just can't believe it. And everything is just so dramatic for the whole rest of the day, and you're literally manifesting, you're having a bad day for the rest of your day. And by the way, you've ruined everybody's day around you for having to hear your story. And so I started to really sort of like feel that and hear that. And so I heard this through a friend of a friend that my mom was out whining and complaining about how, you know, basically I had abandoned her and, you know, and put it all on me. And I thought it was just the strangest thing. And I don't know what possessed me to do it other than, like I said, this book. But I sat down and I wrote her a letter. And it was the only time that I've ever reached out to her.
So timeline, you're 98, you're in Starbucks. Like, when does this letter come?
Four or five years after. So I hadn't seen or spoken to her in 4 or 5 years at this point.
And you've been working through this awareness and this regret and this weight for quite a while then, by the time you...
Sure, I had 19 years of anger and animosity, and then there was the TV situation, and then for that point, there's like another 3 years of just... of the rage and that fuel that I was talking about that was thrusting everything. And now I had had about a year since this, The Game of Life and How to Play It book, of all of a sudden I'm doing all this other great work in other areas of my life and creating all these friendships and everything is going really beautifully, but still there's that buzz that's coming from my mom. And so I sit down and I write this letter, and this is one of those, when I call spiritual moments, where I just sort of channeled it because I didn't know what I was going to write or what I wanted to say, and I just started writing it. And, you know, I was young, so there's definitely a couple jabs at her where it's like, you know, I hope, what did the pawn shop pay for that TV? I hope it was, you know, worth the price of losing a son. You know, there are a couple of those. But then the last couple paragraphs were really more about, I want you to know that I'm living a very good life and it's very fulfilled and I have amazing friendships and I'm quite successful. And at the time, I was working on What Lies Beneath and Castaway, so I'm like, trust me, I'm living a dream way more abundant than I ever could have imagined as that teenager. And I said, so know that I'm doing well, and also know that I wish you well. I wish you well. I hope that you have a great things, you know, great things happen for you, and I hope that you have a wonderful life. Just know that you're not welcome to be a part of mine. And I did send her that letter. I know she received it. She never responded to it. She never had a reaction to it. But that letter transformed me. And it completely changed my fear of her. And I recognized that I didn't need anything from her. And what I realized that I had always been wanting is I wanted ownership. Because oftentimes if somebody wrongs us, what we're really looking for is for them to have ownership over how they wronged us. Because then all of a sudden it's like, okay, well then, you know, now I know why I felt so bad, and so now I can forgive you. But the truth of the matter is, when we're wronged at such a level like that, that person is very highly unlikely not going to ever come to us and be like, you know, I'm sorry I was such a terrible mother. I was, you know, I'm sorry that I cheated on you. I did it because I felt bad about myself. Whatever those things are. But again, going back to the, I was drinking the poison and expecting her to die. In saying, I wish you well, all of a sudden, she became so much more powerless and so much more insignificant. And, you know, one of the things we talked about, that's the significant moment, but that doesn't mean that that was the day that everything was all of a sudden great. There was still more of a process, but that it was so transformative to being able to finally just say, I forgive you, move on. Like,
well, religious people for a long time have ritualized moments, and we sometimes confuse the moment as the event, but the event was, I believe in your story, years of awareness and growth and maturity. I think you can't grow into maturity until you get in this forgiveness flow, because it is the nature of the universe that God has created. But something happened in that you made a ritual out of writing this thing that capstoned that all that work ahead, that the process was still moving, and it's still going. It didn't stop when the letter happened, because you're even looking back on that letter, critiquing part of some of the things you said, saying, yeah, that wasn't my best self. Doing it again might be different. But in that, I've seen that again and again, where people have come to big moments, and it's not the moment itself that is the event of forgiveness, but they have ritualized that by writing a letter, by burying something in the ground, by floating something out into the river or the sea. They've made a spiritual practice. They've knelt, or they have done something that says, this is not going to be me anymore. It's not going to define my existence, and have moved from that. And I think as you talked, you described it to me, it sounded like a religious ritual where you moved into a space. You talked about channeling. You talked about listening. You talked about how those things happen, and they can be very powerful when big hurts come.
It impacted, of course. It impacted my spirituality, from the woman at the cafe to the book to the, you know, to everything else, and it impacts my life today. You know, again, if I had gone down that other path, and if I had kept hanging on to that betrayal that my mother had given me, I was never going to be open to love, because it took me until my mid-30s to learn to love myself. You know, I was single for 13 years after coming out. Like, there was no relationship. You know, but to be the person I am today, I mean, I've got a whole corner full of friendships back there that I love, that are like family to me. You know, I've got Brad's family here today, who I'm able to just be completely open in my capacity to love and let them in, because I'm not still holding on to the grudge towards my mother. You know, I don't let her, the buzzing is gone. She's a part of the fabric, which, you know, Brad's about to sing a song that means the world to me. And it's an old Bette Midler song from the 70s, and I had heard it 100 times. But after the forgiveness part, one day I was listening to it, and it just made me start crying, because the song is called In My Mother's Eyes, and it talks about, I got mother's eyes and my father's hair, and the idea that forever I'm going to have my mother's eyes. I'm going to always see the world partly through her eyes. She can't go away, but she's part of who I am today. I love who I am today, and I'm proud of who I am today, and I'm proud of all that I've accomplished today. And to have not forgiven her would mean that I was pretending she didn't exist, and to pretend that she didn't exist would mean that I was also taking away a large piece of myself. And so again, like, the song that he's about to sing is also about, you know, but I'm still walking with my head held high, in spite of all of the stuff that I had to go through with her. And so that's why forgiveness was such a, I learned so much. I expanded so much I transformed so much just by a simple act. And again, I never had to hear from her. I never had to hear her say, Bob, I'm sorry, I was a terrible mom. I'll probably never hear that. The truth of the matter, it's now been 21 years since the TV incident. I've not had any communication with her in 21 years. She's now been out of my life longer than she was in my life. That's what I've had to work through the most, is to make sure that I'm okay with that. And I'm pretty confident that I am. I don't have any... As far as I know, I don't have any unresolved issues. I certainly have the opportunity, if I felt I needed to reach out to her, I would, but I don't.
Forgive me if I stay with my mother's eyes.
So just for a couple-minute conversation, turn back to that same group you were talking about with, and we asked you a question about what are the economic consequences if you lived in a forgiveness system that holds debts that rely on this one-time event. But what's the opportunity for you if you lived in a different system? If you lived in a gift economy, in a relational exchange economy, just for a second, can you name what is possible? What's that, the potential for you? If this forgiveness flow would be something you would enter in, what is the potential there? Name that. 2 minutes.
And all this pain, I wonder if I'll ever find my way. I wonder if my life could really change. And all this could all that is lost ever be found? Could a garden come up from this ground? Sing this together. You things.